Hello everyone and welcome to the third season of the History of Modern Greece, where we cover the subject of the fall of Constantinople to the modern day. I am your host, Daniel Roberts, and I'm here with my father, George.
Hi, my name is George.
And our music is brought to you by Mark Youngerman. This is Season 3, Episode 82. A letter that changed the world. When we left our narrative in Season 2, the Roman Emperor, Alexios Komnenos, saved the empire from total collapse. The Byzantine Golden Age was nothing more than a fleeting memory. The empire had fractured in many places. All of Italy was lost to the Normans, and almost all of Anatolia belonged to the Turks. The Balkans were suffering constant raids from the Pechenegs, and these were just the external threats. The empire was plunged into civil war after civil war. And that was when the mighty Alexios came to power. With no money and often very few soldiers, the new emperor crushed the Normans, retook the coastal region of Anatolia, and pushed back the Pechenegs. Alexios not only saved the empire from certain death, but he started a rejuvenation period. For the first time in decades, there was hope. There was only one problem. He was broke. He needed to kick those damn Turks out of Anatolia. That was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. It is where the most tax revenue was collected, and it was where most of the soldiers came from. And it was also the gateway between the East and the West. It was partially linked to the Silk Road. The border to his west was temporarily secured after defeating Bohemond, and all of the Normans were ejected from Greece. The Balkan Peninsula was more or less secured. To put it bluntly, the Pechenegs were all but wiped out in 1091. There were survivors, but as a flourishing tribe of people, yeah, they were gone. The Alexiad chronicles the total annihilation of their main caravan. Men, women, and children. Massacred. Today we would call it genocide. But at the time, this was great news for the Romans. Now if only Alexios could replicate the total genocide and use it against the Seljuks. There was only one problem. He was broke. No money, no soldiers, he had nothing. Nothing but the ability to promise rewards for those who helped him. It's a hard sell for many. It's almost like hiring bank robbers to rob a bank for you. But instead of paying them up front, you promise to pay them with the money they are stealing from the bank. What's stopping them from just keeping all the money for themselves? Surely, this was a thought going through Alexios' mind. I need soldiers who will fight and conquer for me. But I also need them to give the land directly back to me afterwards. Alexios was a wise man. We know this from the way he got himself out of difficult situations before. He knew the terrain of Anatolia. He knew the way the Turks fought. He knew their strengths and their weaknesses. He also knew how the Norman knights fought in battle. Alexios sat at his desk and pondered the entire situation, and eventually came up with a number. The number of the perfect amount of Norman knights he would need to hire to fight the Turks and push them out of Anatolia forever. Alexios sat down at his desk and unfolded a piece of papyrus, or lambskin, or whatever it was that Roman emperors wrote with in the late 11th century. He told his closest advisors of his plans, including his generals and his family. It was a long shot, really. I mean, who would really answer his call for help? Who was most likely to answer? Was it the Pope? I mean, it was only a few years before this that the Great Schism happened and the Pope excommunicated the Eastern Church, and vice versa. But let's see what happens.
In 1093, Alexios wrote a letter to a count in France, a man named Robert of Flanders. He asked for a couple of thousand soldiers to help out in Anatolia. He said that all of Anatolia was about to fall to the Turks, and if it did, countless Christian treasures, both physical and spiritual, would go to the Turks if that happened. But he also appealed to the adventurous side of the Frankish Norman warriors and said that they will find all of the treasures and also the most beautiful women of the Orient. The incomparable beauty of the Greek women would seem to be sufficient reason to attract the armies of the Franks. There are many copies of this letter sent to Count Robert of Flanders, the Frisian. However, it has been determined by most scholars that the letter used as propaganda for the crusade was a forgery. We have looked for the original letter, but so far we have been unable to locate a copy. When Alexios finished writing that letter, he had it sealed with the official Roman Emperor's seal, then carried it from Constantinople, through the Balkans, and the Hungarian Kingdom, and the Holy Roman Empire, modern-day Belgium. While Alexios watched the letter carrier disappear into the busy city of Constantinople, he probably went about his day-to-day life without thinking much would ever come from it. The worst-case scenario was no one would come at all. The best-case scenario? 2,000 knights come to his aid and help kick out those pesky Seljuks. Little did he know, his little letter was going to cause so big a stir.
That is so fascinating, how history can be so altered by such a simple little thing.
As someone from the present looking back on history, it's easy to say that this single letter kick-started a war that changed the world forever. The terrible events that followed, the entire series of crusades, could they all have been prevented if that one letter carrier died while hiking through the mountains? Were the events that followed destined to happen no matter what? Would the Normans and the Franks and the rest of Europe join together and invade the Holy Land? If that letter carrier running through the mountains with Alexios' message died, would the Normans continue fighting the Romans? Would the Crusades ever happen? Would anyone ever give a damn about the Holy Land? We will never know, because nearly 1,000 years ago, that letter did make it from Constantinople to the Count of Flanders. He opened the letter addressed to him. It had a very special seal, the seal of the Roman Emperor in Constantinople. Count Robert of Flanders knew this letter was important and took it to Pope Urban II, who gave a speech at the council which ignited the spirit of crusade in the hearts and minds of the Christian nobles of medieval Europe. Who is Pope Urban II? I'm glad you asked, because you need to know just who this guy was and what his motivations and intentions were. Pope Urban's name at birth was Odo de Lagory. He was born in a place called Châtillon in northern France. He was born in 1035, so he had seen a lot go down in his lifetime.
The last time we talked about the papacy in Season 2, it was in regard to the Great Schism of 1054. So why don't we pick things up from where we left them? The Pope responsible for the Great Schism was Pope Leo IX. As we discussed before, there was a weird relationship between the Eastern and Western churches. When the Empire abandoned Italy, they basically left the Pope to run under the control of the Ostrogoths, then the Lombards, and the Franks. The Pope was left on his own and often had to make callous decisions just to survive. Italy was a violent place after the Roman Empire crumbled, so the Pope did not like being told what to do by the Patriarch in Constantinople. And one day, they got into an argument over the authority of ritual, which devolved into an angry letter exchange, which led to both churches excommunicating each other. At the time, many people thought this was just another hissy fit thrown between the two bishops. But it was a tear in the fabric that would never stop tearing. The ironic part of the story is that Pope Leo IX died the same year he excommunicated the Eastern Church. But this pope should not be looked at as some old pope who just got into a fit and broke apart from the East. Pope Leo IX fought in battles. He was the pope during the Norman Papal Wars. He led an army out of the walls to fight the mighty Norman army. Pope Leo IX was a badass pope who just so happened to go a little fanatic with the ritual differences between Greek and Latin churches. Little did he know, he was sowing the seeds for the Crusades. When Pope Leo IX died, Pope Victor II took over. He was only in power for 2 years before he died in 1057. He wasn't in long enough to make any real impact, but when he died, the good relationship the papacy held with the dynasty of the Holy Roman Emperors died as well. At this time, the last of the Macedonian dynasty in Constantinople also disappeared. In 1057, a man named Frederick was elected by the cardinals and became Pope Stephen IX. Frederick had spent his whole career in the papacy, and in fact he worked under Pope Leo IX. He was there when the Normans rose hell in southern Italy, and he also was assigned to the group sent to Constantinople, and was present and even participated in the discussions which broke down and resulted in the Great Schism. He even worked under Pope Victor II. Now get this. He was only 37 years old when he became pope. And popes, like kings and emperors, once in office, they are there for life. So you can imagine just how long his reign was. In 1058 CE, a year after taking office, Pope Stephen IX died at age 38.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that guy could be 1 year.
He was traveling to Florence when an agent of the Romans poisoned him. I don't know if these Romans are the Greeks in Byzantium or the Germans in Europe, but they were Roman. Now, this was a troublesome time for the papacy, and an election was held. But the vote seemed suspicious, and it was discovered that the election was rigged. So a new man was elected pope, and his name was Gerard of Burgundy. He was 70 years old when he took office, and adopted the name Nicholas II. He is the pope who decided to accept the Normans as the rightful rulers of southern Italy. And he is the one who bestowed Robert Guiscard with the title of Duke. He even gave his blessing to the Norman invasion of Sicily, led by Robert Guiscard and his younger brother Roger. Alas, the Pope was in office for less than 3 years, and he spent most of his term fighting the anti-Pope who rigged the election before him. His most significant achievement in office was bringing over 100 bishops together to reform the process of electing the next pope, to make sure there were no more irregularities in the process.
In 1061, Pope Nicholas died, and the church was forced to hold a new election. It seems no big deal, but they just implemented a new system. So for the first time in the 1,000-year history of the Church, The election of the Pope excluded the people of Rome. It excluded the clergy. It also excluded the nobles of Rome. The new election even went as far as excluding the Holy Roman Emperor from deciding the new pope. The new pope was elected by a council made up entirely of the cardinals. This seems like a great win for democracy. Sort of. But in reality, all it did was lead to further schism.
The tear in the fabric kept tearing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, there's somewhere in one of the Gospels where they said when Jesus died, the curtain of the Holy of the Holies was torn. Mm. So it's symbolic because it obviously didn't happen. Mm-hmm.
A man named Anselm of Baguio was elected to be the very next pope. He was the first pope to be elected solely by the cardinals. He took the name of Alexander II. But wouldn't you know it, the Holy Roman Emperor was pissed off that he was cut out of the election process. So he declared his own candidate to be the pope. So for all of Pope Alexander II's reign, there was another pope, funded by the Germans, that challenged him on every occasion and even led armies against the papal states. Pope Alexander II reigned for 12 years. The beginning of his reign saw him pitted between the Normans in the south and the Holy Roman Empire in the north. The city of Rome was besieged numerous times under his reign. But after holding on for many years, he established his place in Italy. Here is an interesting fact. Pope Alexander II called for a crusade. But it wasn't a crusade against the Turks in Anatolia, nor a crusade to take back the Holy Land. Pope Alexander II sanctioned a crusade against the Moors in Spain.
Wow, cool. That is cool.
In 1064, Pope Alexander II sanctioned an army to besiege and capture the Spanish city of Barbastro. It wasn't called a crusade, but it was an army that was assembled by the Pope, made up of soldiers and knights from all across Western Europe, that attacked the Caliphate in Spain to liberate a city that used to belong to the Romans a long, long time before. It was basically a proto-crusade. Knights from Aquitaine, Aragon, and Normandy invaded Moorish territory and brutally captured the city of Bastro. It is written that the siege went on for so long that many within the city died of thirst-related diseases. And when the Muslim forces finally surrendered the city to the Crusaders, they made a deal to let them march out of the gate and return to Andalusia. As the soldiers left the gates, the Crusaders massacred the men and stormed the city. They hacked and stabbed their way through the streets and houses and killed most of the men. The women and children were forced to convert and then taken as wives, concubines, comfort women. Who are we kidding? They were slaves. In 1066, Pope Alexander II commissioned the Norman invasion of England. Until this point, the papacy had very little control over England. They had been so devastated by the Viking raids. But with William the Conqueror in control of England, the Pope was able to send bishops and cardinals to the British Isles. He expanded his reach in Poland and even Bohemia. He was the first Pope to be elected by the new system and was also the longest reigning Pope in many years.
On April 21st, 1073, Pope Alexander II died. He was 58 years old. With the new system of electing popes still strongly enforced, a man named Hildebrand of Savona was elected as pontiff. And just like the pope that came before him, His election angered the Holy Roman Emperor, and an anti-pope was elected in his place. But this man, Hildebrand, went on to become one of the greatest popes of the medieval period. His name was Gregory VII, and his reign lasted from 1073 to 1085. He was also 58 years old when he took office, and he really stood up to the Holy Roman Emperor, and even went as far as excommunicating the Holy Roman Emperor several times. That means he excommunicated the emperor, then the emperor did something to earn forgiveness, but then went against the pope and was excommunicated again. This happened 4 times. It's safe to say that by this time in history, the pope and the Holy Roman Emperor, not good friends. The German armies marched south and crossed the Alps. They besieged the city of Rome and even captured it briefly. But the Norman army, led by Robert Guiscard himself, marched north and forced the German soldiers out of the city. However, Robert Guiscard may have liberated the Pope from the Germans, but he let his Norman knights plunder the city. And when the Normans left, the Roman citizens rose up and chased the Pope out of town. Pope Gregory VII sought exile in Salerno, where he ended up dying in the year 1085 CE. The cardinals elected another old man to be the Pope, and his name was Victor III. But he was sick when he was elected, and tried to refuse the seat. But the cardinals had spoken, and he was installed as the Pope. But his health never got better. And the very next year, on September 27th, 1087, Pope Victor III died. The next pope elected to the Catholic Church was a man named Odo. Odo of Châtillon. Odo had been in the church during the great Gregorian reforms, which saw the morality of the clergy clamped down. Their ability to be bought off by the Holy Roman Empire was diminished. Odo was also there to see the downfall of the Eastern Roman Empire. When he was born, the Byzantine Empire was still strong. But by the time he became Pope, the Eastern Roman Empire had all but collapsed. He also had to deal with the anti-popes installed by the Holy Roman Emperor. The very legitimacy of the papacy was constantly challenged by the Holy Roman Emperor. This man worked under Gregory, and then briefly under Victor. And when he was elected Pope, and installed in March 1088 CE, he took the name Pope Urban II. And even before becoming Pope, Urban II had to deal with the anti-pope, Clement III. And the constant wars in medieval Italy, and the struggles between the Roman Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire. He was there when the emperor was humiliated and had to walk along the road to Canossa to submit his authority to the papacy. Pope Urban II spent his entire life watching the papacy struggle to maintain its authority and struggle against the Holy Roman Empire, who elected their own pope and paraded him around. There were constant invasions and assaults by the Normans in the south. And if you recall the situation Emperor Alexios was in when he took office, which was right around this time, by the way, it is kind of similar to the situation Pope Urban II was in. Enemies on all sides. Never enough resources to carry out your plans. And never having a moment to rest. Catch your breath.
If you recall our episode in Season 1 about the Frankish Kingdoms and the episode in Season 2 about the Holy Roman Empire, there was an old theme in medieval Europe. This is where the father of a kingdom would divide his kingdom up among all his sons. And when he died, they went to war until there was only one brother left. This left Western Europe stuck in an endless cycle of wars. This tradition has been done away with by this time in the story. What happened now was the father or king would leave his kingdom to his eldest son, and the younger sons would be shit out of luck. This left a lot of angry princes in Europe with nothing left to do but fight each other. They rode around the countryside and formed bands of knights, and they really raised hell in the countryside.
Well, this is all leading up to, this is going to be an outlet.
Mm-hmm.
An outlet. This is awesome. Where'd you pick that up, this information?
Doing research on the popes.
Yeah. Wow. You sure can't ignore one aspect, can you?
No.
You got to cover all aspects.
We might as well let you know what the climate was like during this period. You know they have a name for it. They call it the medieval warm period. This was not a global warming period, but more of a northern hemisphere warming period. Europe warmed up, and the climate changed. Summer was long, and the growing period was longer. Winters were still cold, but not as deadly as before. In other parts of the world, there was drought, including the United States and Central Asia. It was a fascinating time to be alive. What did this mean for our European friends? It meant more growing seasons, more crop yields, but also longer fighting seasons, more war. What did this mean for Eurasian steppe tribes? It meant their animals had no food, and they were forced to bring their flocks south to greener pastures, where the nomadic world collided with a settled world. Pope Urban II had to account for all of this. The world was a chaotic mess. There was fighting all over, and climatic and geopolitical change was in the air. It was at this time, more than 7 years into his reign, that Pope Urban II traveled to the northern Italian kingdom of Piacenza, where they held a council for the clergy. The whole point of this council was to show the people that he was the rightful pope and not the anti-pope put into place by the Holy Roman Emperor. If you were watching this council, you might think that the most important attendees were the French, or the Germans, or maybe the Italians. Little did they know that it was actually the presence of a Greek man who would impact the world so greatly. Alexios Komnenos, ambassador and letter carrier, was present at the council. And he told the Pope that the Roman Empire had lost Anatolia to the Seljuk Turks, and he needed help taking the land back. He needed some knights to help drive the Turks back east, and if he could spare 2,000 Norman knights, the emperor would be in his debt. It was also an opportunity to heal the rift between the East and West churches. Urban II mulled over this news for quite some time. It wasn't until later that year, in November 1095 to be exact, in the city of Clermont, that Urban II held another council. For 6 days, the council talked about the church reforms and the election reforms, argued over marriage laws and why it was important for members of the church to remain celibate. All the fun, usual church stuff. But it was the last day of the council, the seventh day, that Pope Urban II said he had a big announcement and asked everyone to go outside in the field to hear his speech. He had stands constructed to hold all the spectators. It was a cold November day, and everyone was eager to hear what the Pope had to say. It is important to stress that before this speech, there had already been a crusade in Spain, and the Norman invasions of Greece were fresh in everyone's memory. The Eastern Roman Empire was wounded, and everyone smelt the blood in the water. So it is hard to say for sure if this speech would have happened whether Alexios asked for help or not. But it does not matter, because Alexios did ask for help, and this speech did change the world forever.
On November 27, 1095, Pope Urban II gave a speech at the Council of Clermont in central France. Unfortunately, this speech wasn't written down, and the only accounts we have were written by eyewitnesses some 20 years later. And they all vary slightly. But the most accurate one we believe to be true comes from Robert of Clermont. For most scholars agree that he was present at the speech. So here it goes. The speech that changed the world forever. This land which you inhabit, shut in on all sides by the seas and surrounded by the mountain peaks, is too narrow for your large population, nor does it abound in wealth, and furnishes scarcely food enough for its cultivators. Hence it is that you murder one another, that you wage war, and that frequently you perish by mutual wounds. Let therefore hatred depart among you. Let your quarrels end. Let war cease. And let all dissensions and controversy slumber. Enter upon the road to the Holy Sepulchre. Wrest that land from the wicked race and subject it to yourselves. God has conferred upon you above all nations great glory in arms. Accordingly, undertake this journey for the remission of your sins with the assurance of the imperishable glory of the kingdom of heaven. The Pope then shouted, "It is the will of God!" And the rest of the crowd shouted back,
It is the will of God! It is the will of God! It is the will of God!
And the Pope continued, "Most beloved brethren, today manifests in you what the Lord says in the Gospel, where two or more are gathered in thy name, there am I in the midst of them. Unless the Lord God had been present in your spirits, all of you would not have uttered the same cry. Although the cry was issued from numerous mouths, the origin of the cry was one. Therefore I say to you that God, who implanted his in your hearts, has drawn it forth from you. Let this then be your war cry in combat, because his word is given to you. And when an armed attack is made upon the enemy, let this one cry be raised by all the soldiers of God. It is the will of God.
It is the will of God.
It is the will of God.
It is the will of God.
The Pope talked about pilgrims going to the Holy Land and being slaughtered along the way. The women raped, the women killed. The churches being torn down or turned into mosques. Or worse, turned into stables for their animals. He talked about the Holy Sepulchre, the holiest church in all the Holy Land, being burned to the ground, even though these claims were greatly exaggerated, and the church being burned down happened nearly 75 years before this point, and it was burned down by the Fatimids, not the Seljuks, and it was already rebuilt. But the effect this speech had on the people watching was unreal. It ignited the fire of crusade in their hearts. But then, the Pope added another line that really spread the word to all those living in Europe. And these words made everyone want to give up their wonderful lives in Europe. Just kidding. Their miserable lives in Europe and travel to the Holy Land. All those who die along the way, whether by land or by sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sin. This I grant them through the power of God, with which I am invested. Begun, the Crusades have. So that's our first episode of Season 3, the beginning of the Crusades. Anything strike your mind?
He had as much trouble around him than
Alexios
had. And what a way to get it out of his back door.
Well,
and channel all those useless energies against him and
send it off to the...
That's. I started thinking about that halfway through the episode. Do you think he ever intended for the Crusades to work? Or was he just trying to get these barbarians out of Europe who were causing so much trouble? And if they all died along the way, would it just have been as good for the Pope?
Well, it's a tactic that's been used for thousands of years. Like the Romans did it too. What they do, they're being onslaughted by the Bulgarians, so they paid these guys over here some money to attack them.
Mm-hmm.
It's redirecting
mm-hmm.
your enemies.
So all the enemies that were in Europe, you just redirected them out of Europe.
Yeah, because the whole Holy Roman Empire was big, and they're on his case all the time. This way now,
mm-hmm.
they've gone to the Middle East.
And the French, they also had princes.
Yeah.
Lots of princes who weren't inheriting land, who had lots of money and armor and swords.
Chaos. No, I think he saw a chance for a solution to the problems that were plaguing Europe.
Mm-hmm. Little did he know.
Little did he know.
Well, that's it for today. Join us next time on the history of modern Greece. Stay safe and stay awesome.